Hello, everybody. It's my great pleasure to introduce Suresh, who's here on sabbatical all this year. He's living in the FS corridor and is, I'm sure, happy to talk to people. He explained to me his long and illustrious history.
Not sure about two minutes ago,
but he's too, as you can see, too self-effacing to wish me to reproduce this, so I shall advertise him only as apparently the author of the first Lynda compiler, I'm not sure why, but also a co-author of the fastest ML implementation in the West. And the East, and now interested in, for a long time, in fact, interested in all kinds of transactional mechanisms.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So before I go into the technical details of what the title actually means, let me pose a much more abstract problem. And from there, we'll try to derive how that relates to what I'd like to really talk about. So here's the problem. Suppose I have a collection of threads, and I want to group these threads into two groups, an A group and a B group. And I would like to have two properties that I want to associate on these threads. I'd like all of the A threads to just talk to each other, like all of the B threads to talk to each other. And I want to make sure that the A threads don't see things that the B threads do, the B threads don't see things that the A threads do. And periodically, we'll break up these clouds so that they can sort of form new groups and then start over again. I'm going to add one twist to this problem. And the twist is that periodically, I'll allow a thread from one group to go to another group. Okay? And when I do that, it can start communicating with threads in that group as well. But there's a caveat here. In order for it to do this, in order for us to sort of maintain our illusion that everything is still separate, we have to make sure that it doesn't talk to any of the B threads again, or any of the A threads in this example, any of the A threads again, unless we can move those A threads as well, unless we can move those guys down as well. Now, the trick here, or the sort of twist again, another twist again, is that we have these threads that are marked with these anchors, and these threads can't move at all. Okay? So if I ever have a thread that I move from one group to another group, and it needs to actually talk to one of these anchor guys, then we've got a mistake. We've got a problem. So now the question is, how do we actually go about building up a partitioning of threads in this way so that everybody can talk to each other as long as they're allowed to do so? And we allow this sort of migration, as it were, conceptual migration of threads from one group to another group, subject to these caveats. In a sense, right, this can be easily done, right? I can imagine writing a protocol that keeps around information about what group I'm in, and that sort of moves around guys from one group to another group as long as it's safe to do so. But there is a little bit of complexity here, right? A little bit of messiness, because the decision about whether I can actually move a thread from one group to another depends upon things that the thread is going to do in the future, right? It's okay to move it as long as it doesn't do anything in the future that's going to violate this constraint that it doesn't talk to guys that can't be moved afterwards. So that's the kind of problem that we'd like to look at. Now, if you sort of go down from this 50,000-foot level down a little bit to something that's more pragmatic, what we've really done is talk about a notion of serializability on communication actions between disjoint groups of threads. That's really what we're trying to do. And these sort of anchor points represent guys that have to be completely isolated from one another, represent threads that can never have their effects broadcast from via the communications that they do from one anchor point to another anchor point. Okay, so that's sort of the big picture. Now, how do we go about actually trying to come up with mechanisms, language abstractions and implementation techniques that allow us to do this? So that's what I'll spend the rest of the talk focusing on. Right, so in that very, very brief high-level description, I introduced implicitly a whole bunch of concepts that are found in transactional memory systems and concurrency control algorithms, right? One important concept is the notion of atomicity. I'd like to have a group of threads work together such that their effects don't get witnessed by the other group until we break up this cloud, right? Until the clouds get broken up, and then they can sort of talk to one another again. I have this very obvious notion of isolation that says that I can't allow information to cross from one group to another group unless we can prove that if we do move this thread over, that it'll never sort of propagate the information backwards to guys in the other group. So the question is, if I want to express these kinds of notions, I want to reflect these properties in a real language, How do I do it if I actually don't have a notion of a single shared memory where I can sort of acquire a global lock, for example, that throttles how accesses to data takes place? But instead, I've got this sort of soup of different threads that are communicating through messages, where there isn't a single notion, a single single point where I can sort of control accesses to the information that these threads are propagating. So that's what we're trying to address. So the question is, how do we build a notion of serializable execution in the sense of the previous problem in a world where threads communicate not through shared memory updates but through message passing? And how do we do it in a world where the kind of communication patterns that we have are very dynamic? So it's not like MPI where I sort of lay out all of the particular channels up front, but where I allow threads to sort of dynamically engage in communication protocols with one another without necessarily specifying up front. Okay. So let me give you some more motivation and a few more examples to sort of give you the context about where we are. So, and before I go on, let me emphasize that what I've said so far, in your mind, you might envision a whole bunch of different ways of solving these problems, right? So what I'm saying, what I want to make very clear is, I'm not arguing that they can't be done. They can certainly be done. These kinds of problems can certainly be addressed. What I'm really interested in figuring out is, can we do it with the minimal amount of conceptual burden on the programmer, where we can sort of abstract away all of the plumbing and logic that needs to be typically done in order to weave a protocol logic that allows us to implement this kind of serialization notion away from the programmer and sort of put the burden onto the implementation and the compiler, for example. So here's another very simple example. I have a thread, and it wants to communicate to two other threads atomically. So it wants to send messages to threads B and C atomically. And I want to be able to write a protocol that captures this notion with the minimal amount, again, of conceptual burden on the programmer. So whatever protocol I discover, it has to do a bunch of things. It has to be robust in the presence of a bunch of possible conditions. One of them is maybe C isn't ready to accept any information from A, but I've already sent something to B. Okay, that's one problem. Maybe before C actually receives something from A, it chooses to get something from D, right? So we have to make sure that that doesn't happen, because that would violate our atomicity property that both messages get sent instantaneously, as it were, from A. Maybe E accepts something from B before C actually gets its information from A, right? Again, we want to make sure that B is only allowed to proceed once we know that A has propagated its information to both B and C. Now, in a sense, right, this kind of distributed protocol, as I've described, is typically handled by having by doing a sort of two-phase commit or n-phase commit kind of strategy, where you typically set up a series of messages to B and C that says, from A, that says, look, you can't do anything until I tell you it's okay, and the only thing you can do is accept stuff from me. And once that's done, once A is satisfied, it sends back a finalization message that says, okay, everything is okay, you can go ahead and do your stuff. So the question that we'd like to ask is it possible for us to actually express that kind of protocol, for example, with B and C being oblivious to the underlying plumbing, right? What I'd really like to do is to simply allow A to communicate to B and C and have somehow, I don't know how yet, somehow an implementation figure out when B and C do something wrong, or even better, prevent B and C from doing any of these things, such as accepting messages before they ought to, without having the programmer weave this plumbing explicitly. Okay. So this is really a discovery problem, right? We have a collection of possible communications that we can engage in, and what we're really trying to do is to discover those communications that are consistent with this particular protocol. Yeah, for this particular case, absolutely, yes. So you can actually do it, the model changes a little bit, yes? But in this particular case, as I've described it so far, A expects some action to be received on B. A expects B to perform some action, namely receive this message. And the constraint that it's imposing is that B can't do anything until A says it's okay. Now, whether A chooses to tell B afterwards that it's okay to go ahead, for example, can be done asynchronously or synchronously, we don't know. But give me a second. I'll sort of provide more details. But for now, it's simple to think in terms of synchronous communication. Okay, so here's one way that we can. Here's another a simple example. Suppose that I want a thread T1 to send a message synchronously to thread T2, and T2 is going to read this message, perform some computation on it, and if the answer is true, it wants to send an OK signal back. It wants to allow T1 to go ahead. If the computation that it performs, the computation that T2 performs is false, it's going to say not OK. Right? Now, there are a couple of problems with this. The first is, and it works, obviously, but the first is that there's a loss of abstraction here, right? T1 has to know that after it sends the message to T2, and T2 has gotten it, that it still is not allowed to go ahead and do its own thing, because it's got to wait for T2 to say that the argument that it sent, the value x that it sent, is actually a reasonable argument that it's willing to accept. So that means that there has to be a protocol that's on the receiver side, on T1, that says, let me wait for T2 to come back to me and say that the message that I sent was actually reasonable. Because if it wasn't, then I have to do something else. So it means that we need to have sort of a handshake between T1 and T2. That's okay. The other problem is that we have to make sure that T2 has to be aware that T1 is actually going to do the waiting. If T1 incorrectly, mistakenly doesn't wait, and T2 is just in this sort of synchronous world where T2 says, look, I want to make sure that you don't go ahead and pretend that everything is okay, T2 is going to have to wait presumably forever because T1 is never going to accept this message. So we'd like to figure out a way of avoiding this, of perhaps abstracting away all of this plumbing. So here's one thing that we might do. Suppose that I send a message from T1 to T2, and I pretend that this is sort of a tentative message. So T1 sends something to X. T2 waits and performs some computation. And if the computation holds, then essentially what we do is we turn that tentative communication into a real communication, right? So we pretend that it's in some weird other state. And once we get confirmation from T2, not in some form, we'll commit the message, right? So T1 can then pretend that everything is okay. And there's no explicit handshake here. This is being done entirely under the covers. So similarly, if we get something that's false, we pretend that nothing happened at all, right? It's as though T1 never sent the message, and it's just back in the state that it was before it did anything whatsoever. So this is nice in some sort of, in a high-level sense, this is quite nice because I haven't woven the acknowledgement protocol into the communication between T1 and T2. T1 doesn't have to be aware of how T2 is actually working. Maybe T2 doesn't need to compute f of x at all. Maybe T2 just accepts its actions and it's done. In any case, we've avoided the need to sort of weave the back protocol that defines the handshake. So let's pretend that we generalize this, right? Rather than having just T1 and T2, imagine that we have a client, some protocol that we want to build on the client side, and a collection of servers, say, a collection of other threads that we want to communicate against. And we'd like to be able to sort of build the same kind of abstraction between the communications that occur between the clients and these different servers. So how might we do that? Well, one thing, let's start off with a very simple example. Let's pretend that my two servers that I'm going to be talking with have some local state, have some state that they manage. So let's call it N and N prime. So a client might issue a tentative query, just as we showed before, to the server. And it might get back some response that says, okay, the state of the server has some value N. And that's okay. We've sort of put a little check mark there, indicating that that particular part of this protocol seems to be satisfied. And now maybe the client goes ahead and performs some other action on the server side, on the other server. Maybe it wants to reserve some number of these resources, say K prime, to the server. And the server is going to do some little check. Okay, if it has enough resources, it's going to say that's okay, and it turns a check. So now notice what we've done is we've increased the scope of the participants in this protocol based on the communication actions that we performed. Whereas before we just had two guys, T1 and T2, now we have three. We have a client and two servers that are involved in this protocol, right? And again, we need a mechanism that's going to allow the protocol to be successful only if all of the participants, in this particular case, the two servers, are willing to commit. Okay? So in a case where we send a communication to the server and the server says, sorry, this isn't the communication I'm not interested in, the protocol has to abort. That means that the interaction with the original server, the actions that the client did with the original server, are also in some sense invalid, and we have to sort of roll that back, if you will. Forget about it. So now the question is it possible, if I have a collection of these threads, to figure out a way of sort of constructing interleavings and communication patterns where I can satisfy a protocol, where I can satisfy this protocol? Maybe the client should have, you know, communicated with another server and gotten more resources, or maybe the server needed to do some other stuff to acquire more resources before it could actually accept this message from the client. In some sense, if there is a satisfiable series of actions that we can perform that would allow this protocol to be discharged safely, we'd like to discover that. And if there isn't, then we'd like to just say, sorry, there's nothing that you can do. There's no sequence of actions that you might be able to perform between the client and these two servers that would actually discharge the requirements that you've stated forth. And in which case, we've got a problem. Okay.
How do you know
when
the sequence of actions is complete?
Yeah, so that's certainly a question. Right. That's the question, right? So we need to figure out, so that's a couple of issues, right? We need to know when we're done, and we need to know we have to find out all the participants, right? Because in some sense, the server can talk to a bunch of other guys as well. Absolutely. So I'll get to that in a second, right? So yeah, there's certainly some challenging questions here. But before I get to that, let me sort of mention some invariants that have to be maintained here. If I allow the client to talk to both of these servers, how do I prevent these servers from talking to somebody else in the interim, right? We just certainly don't want to do that, right? Or maybe we do, but let's for the moment say we don't. We just want to have all the servers talk to this client until the client is about to discharge this protocol. Somehow we'll figure that out. And once it's done, then only should it be allowed to speak to other clients. Because otherwise, you could have one client going in there, sort of consuming resources while underneath the covers, while this other client is blithely assuming that everything is still okay, and it's the only one that's communicating with the server. So we want to make sure that, in this particular example, the server on the bottom can accept requests from client A, but not requests from client B, right? Now this is a little bit challenging, because in some sense, right, we need to make sure that the server doesn't accept requests from client B, but surely can accept multiple requests from client A, right? So the client might want to talk to the server many, many times, so we want to make sure that we don't do something as naive as saying, well, I'm going to talk to the client A exactly once, because that's all that I think the client needs, and if there are other requests, I'm not going to accept it. That would surely prevent communication with client B. I'm only going to accept one request until the client tells me that it's done. But this is a silly argument. This is a silly approach. So what we really need is a mechanism that allows the server to differentiate between client A and client B. So it says, I'm not going to communicate at all with client B. I'm only going to accept communication from client A. Oh, sorry? I'm too quick for my own good. Yeah. Right. Yes. Okay. So, there are a couple of questions. Absolutely. Sorry about that. So, when the client A talks to the server, right, and we want to make sure that the server doesn't talk to the server on the bottom, and we want to make sure that the server doesn't talk to client B, we surely would like, or we may wish, the server to talk to the guy on the top, because they're part of the same protocol. So observe the following. There is a chain of communication actions initiated from client A that may flow down to the server on the bottom. That's perfectly okay, right? But there's another sequence of actions from client B that are not okay. So in some sense, we're trying to tag the information that we actually send on these messages with some kind of history that says, oh, I'm from client A, so you can accept my request. Oh, I'm from client B, and therefore you shouldn't accept my request. The question is, how do you do this? Because this chain could be quite long, It could be fairly complicated. And in the presence of multithreading, client A may have proxies that it generates that communicate on its behalf. We have to keep all of this information around. Okay? So thank you. Now here's the typical way that one might do things, right? The typical solution, or a solution, it might be, let me define a protocol where I build a little private channel. So when the client wants to talk to the server, when client A wants to initiate a communication with the server, what it's going to do is, it starts a little protocol that says, here's a private channel that you're going to use, and or you give me a private channel that I can use to talk to you, and as long as I have access to, and you're going to just listen on that private channel, and until you're done, or until I tell you you're done, that's the only request. Those are the only requests that you're going to. Those are the only communication actions that you're going to receive. Requests that come off of that particular private channel. So what this means is that if the client creates other threads or communicates with other threads on its behalf that also ultimately want to flow information into the server, that particular channel has to be sort of propagated around. It's like a token that has to be propagated around to everyone. This is a little messy because I could have a thread. It now means that every thread that the client A might need to talk to, or every other entity that client A may need to talk to, may potentially talk to the server, we need to sort of propagate this information around everywhere. This is an unpleasant loss of abstraction. Moreover, when the client is actually done, it's got to tell everybody that it possibly spoke to, oh, by the way, this private channel that I gave you access to, that channel is no longer active. So if I created a proxy, for example, to work on my behalf, I have to notify that proxy as well that you can no longer communicate to the server because I'm done with the protocol and I want to go on. So we've lost a little bit of abstraction here. And this loss of abstraction is quite troublesome because it would appear that if you don't have a way of sort of propagating this token around, then we have no way of differentiating or disambiguating between client A and client B, which is what we wanted to do in the first place. So to make this explicit, here's a little diagram that shows what can happen. I could have a client that creates a bunch of threads. I could have another client on the other side that creates a bunch of threads. And I want to make sure that the threads on this side can talk to the server, and the threads on the other side can't, right? So that's what we're going to try to figure out. So there's this transitive effect, right? We need to sort of maintain this transitivity in whatever solution we come up with. So here's one approach that we might consider. We have a client that's talking to the server, right? And one thing that we might be able to do is say, as long as the server will allow the server at any arbitrary point, say, to talk to client B, with the caveat, with the very important caveat that once it chooses to accept a communication from client B, it's not allowed to accept anything else from client A, right? So if we can figure out what that point is, if we can figure out somehow that at this particular juncture in the overall execution of the program, I'm never going to entertain any further communication from client A, then we can sort of allow client B to sort of magically accept communications, I'm sorry, the server, to magically accept communications from client B. Okay. The question is, how do we do that? How do we actually determine whether a message from client B, or a thread communicating on behalf of client B, is in some sense safe, right? That it wasn't somehow influenced by client A. Suppose I do the following. I accept a bunch of messages from client A. I now say, I'm done. Client A is done. I'm not going to accept any more messages because I'm assuming that the client is going to be going off on its own. It's never going to talk to me again. And I'll wait for a message at some point that says it's done. But I'm going to be a little eager. And I'm going to start accepting messages from client B. But it's not just messages from client B, as we saw in the previous slide. It's messages from any thread that could be communicating on behalf of client B. And so, again, we have this idea that we can sort of relax the constraints on how the server communicates with two clients, but we still have this troubling question of how we actually go about figuring out whether a particular thread, a particular communication from some other thread other than client B, who doesn't have the name client B, is valid or not. Okay, so this is all very abstract, and I haven't given you any details whatsoever. So in the time remaining, I'd like to sort of focus in on some sort of concrete manifestation of this problem and a solution. So concretely, we're going to look at concurrent ML, which is a dialect of ML with synchronous message passing. And it has one of the very powerful features of concurrent ML, of CML, is this notion of a first-class event. That is an event, an action, that has latent effect, and whose effects, and which becomes manifest when we do a particular synchronization. So, without belaboring the point for this talk, think of an event as a series of actions, of potential actions. And at some periodic point, at some point, I can synchronize on that event. And when I do that synchronization, all of these actions get discharged, right? The actions sort of fire. Okay, so this is a very powerful notion, but it has a very significant limitation for our purposes. And that limitation is that when I synchronize, I must pick a commit point. That is, if I want to synchronize on an event, and this event is trying to do a send, at the point where I synchronize, that send has to happen, right? Even if there's nobody waiting on the other end, I'm stuck. I'm now saying, yes, you have an event that's trying to do some message communication. I'm going to wait until that communication happens. What we'd really want, in all of our examples, we want something a little bit more abstract, right? Because what we want to be able to do is to have this notion of tentative communication, where A can send to B tentatively, allow B to do some work, and then come back and say, yes, this communication that you sent to me tentatively, it's really a valid communication. You can go ahead. And that ability to sort of interleave communication, tentative communications, with tentative computations that ultimately lead to finalized communications is something that you can't write express in CML as it stands. So there's been some work by Donnelly and Fluitt and Effinger Dean and Grossman, et cetera, that tries to relax this restriction. And they had this very cute notion of transactionalizing, if you will, an event structure. So what this means is essentially allowing us to express some of the problems that we had on the previous slides. So what do? They basically allow an event to be wrapped up, and they allow the commit point of an event, the point where we say we're actually done, to only be triggered once we know all of the particular events inside this encapsulated entity can be discharged, very much like a transaction. Right? So if we can't figure out a particular pairing or a particular sequence of actions that allow this entire event to be discharged, then we fail. We abort, as it were, and we pretend that nothing ever happened at all. So this is an extraordinarily powerful notion because it allows us to write protocols that entail future actions that we don't necessarily know anything about. And based on those future actions, we can sort of now make assertions about the validity of the actions that about the initiation of the protocol in the first place. So here's a very simple example. So this is a guarded receive. That's the manifestation of the example that I gave earlier, where I have a thread that communicates with another thread, and only if the receipt of the value that we sent on the channel applied to function f, say, was true, should the actual communication take place. So here's a guarded receive in CML. So we have a sender, and it's going to send some event, some value x on a channel, and we have a receiver that's going to be defined as an atomic event, a transactional event. Right? And this transactional event is going to be comprised of two pieces. It's going to be comprised of a receipt on the channel, that's the receive event, and a computation of a function f on the value that's picked off of that channel. And if the result of the predicate f of v is true, then we commit. We use this always event. And this always event can be thought of as an action that says, you're done. Right? The transaction is complete. If the predicate yields false, then we yield a never event. And think of a never event as an action, as an event that can never be successfully synchronized on. So if I do sync on the sender, I start the protocol by taking the sender event and synchronizing on it, and if it just so happens that f of v happens to be false, then that sync, it's as though that sync never happened. We're stuck. We have to find somebody else to talk to. But that particular communication just doesn't, transpire. Okay. So this is a very nice model, and let me spend a couple of minutes just trying to explain how we might actually implement this model, okay. And then I'll go on and talk about why this model is not good enough for our purposes, and why we need something why we need something richer. So the execution model that transactional events employs essentially separates out transactional and non-transactional execution. So we can do certain things in any context, right? We can do function calls and function application, and we can create procedures and so forth in any context. We can only create threads in a non-transactional world, right? And every now and then, non-deterministically, if you will, we'll move a group of threads that are trying to be synchronized on, a group of events or threads that have events that are trying to be synchronized against, from the non-transactional world to the transactional world. Okay? And at that point, once we've done this move, we'll now try to discharge these events in this transactional environment. And as long as we can eventually figure out a way of discharging all of those events so that we get always events, we're fine, and then we sort of move back into non-transactional execution. And if we can't, well, then we made a mistake, and we sort of have to find another point at which to sort of do the switch. So diagrammatically, I have a bunch of threads. I create new threads as I go on, and these are all running non-transactionally, right? I do some syncs on some of these threads, and I magically choose somehow to sort of freeze my execution here and start up transactional execution, right? So I allow T1 and T3 to start running transactionally. In this world, we allow communications to take place. They can start communicating with one another. And if they eventually yield always events, then we've guaranteed some atomic behavior. Observe that during the execution of T1 and T3, their events are taking place. Whatever communications they do are not available to anybody else, right? We have atomicity here because we ensure that none of the other threads, T4, T5, et cetera, actually see these intermediate effects that are being done, these intermediate communications that T1 and T3 are engaged in. That's a good thing. Okay. Keep that. In red, I've sort of listed this thing about guarantees atomic but not isolated execution. Just hold off on that. Just sort of mull over that because it's a confusing comment, and I'll tell you what that means in a second. Yes.
And the bottom one has like caps.
Yeah, right. Yes.
And when you say transactional code, you mean code type output event.
Yes.
That's what transactional code is.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So it's the type of then event takes an alpha event and an alpha arrow beta event and yields a beta event.
So it's the bind of the event.
Yes, exactly.
And always is the unit of the event.
That's right. That's right. Okay. So here's a very brief semantic characterization of this. And I won't go into any of the details. I won't go into the details deeply. But if I wanted to formalize this, here's what I might do. I might think about defining my semantics by partitioning the set of transactional events from the set of non-transactional events. So think of k-bar as the transactional soup, and everything else in T-bar as a non-transactional soup. And when I do a sync, what I do is I move the context of the thread and its actions from the non-transactional soup to the transactional soup. So that's what that's doing, right? We just sort of take a particular thread notion, a thread context, and move it from one place to the other. If I do a send or receive, if I'm doing a communication, right? I want to make sure that this communication is always done in a context where I guarantee that no one in the non-transactional soup actually sees anything. So we'll introduce these new kinds of contexts, these F contexts, and think of these F contexts as wrappers that prevent any kind of communication actions that are being done in transactional land from ever being witnessed in any form whatsoever by a non-transactional execution. So we'll continue to evaluate these F contexts until we get always events everywhere. And then once we're done with that, once we have that particular shape in the transactional world, we'll sort of switch back over and run again. Okay? So the point of this is that you can express this precisely. So even though I've been doing a lot of hand waving for the purposes of this talk, just to sort of give you an intuition, you can sort of formalize this quite neatly. The problem is that, and this comes back to the sort of gist of what I was trying to get at in the beginning, the problem is that even though we have this very nice abstract model now for building up transactional events that exhibit this kind of nice atomicity property, they don't address the question that we had from the very beginning, which prevents client A from, which prevents client B from getting in the middle and seeing all the stuff that client A is doing. Because after all, as you've observed, as we've noted so far, all we've done is given a way for us to move a series of threads from one soup, from one pile to another pile, but we haven't figured out any way of sort of constraining how these different guys communicate with one another, right? How do I know that when I do this move, that I haven't moved client B as well? And once I do that, the semantics that we have right now becomes a free-for-all. Everybody can talk to everybody else. And transactional events, as we've described them, don't provide any mechanism for enforcing the degree of isolation that we require. So here's an example that sort of shows what I mean. And the details aren't important. I'll just sort of highlight important characteristics. So here's a little server that sort of is a manifestation of the server code, of the server example that we gave earlier. So it's going to receive events, right? It's going to receive queries from clients. And it's going to do a couple of things, right? It's going to, you know, respond to these queries if they're asking for how many resources you've got. And it's going to reserve some resources if we need to. And it's going to do this inside of a transactional event, right? So it's going to do this inside of a transactional event so that it can accept multiple queries from a client, right? Multiple actions from a client as part of a complex protocol. And it wants to do this completely atomically, because if at some point it fails, for example, the client is repeatedly asking for resources, and at some point the client asks for resources that the server can't provide, then we want to yield a never event, which I haven't shown here, but you want to sort of yield a never event that says, sorry, this protocol is busted, you can't go ahead. And the client is going to tell the server, in this very simple example, when it's done. Okay? So the client is just going to issue a request, says, here, I've given you all my requests, now I'm done. So let's stop. Okay? But observe the following. There's a little recursive call here to event loop, and this is what allows us to sort of build, or this is what allows us to accept more requests. The problem is that there's nothing here that sort of prevents me from accepting a request from another client. Another client can get in there because that channel is just the channel that's open to the server. Or there's nothing that prevents the client A from talking to a thread which has also spoken with client B, unbeknownst to client A, right? Been influenced by client B in some form, and talks to the server on client A's behalf, right? So how do we sort of prevent this gossipy nature of communication? How do we sort of constrain this? If I talk to thread T1, how do I know that T1 hasn't, on the side, spoken with client B and is now acting on his behalf without my knowing it at all? So unfortunately, the atomic event, the transactional event model, certainly allows us to sort of build an all or nothing set of communication actions, right? If we don't do an always event, we're not going to complete, but it doesn't prevent me from isolating the events of the isolating effects from different threads. So here's what I'm going to propose. Let me introduce one new combinator, one new event combinator, and I'm going to call this combinator an isolated event. Okay. And this particular combinator that the client is going to write is going to say the following. It's going to assert that all of the actions that are encapsulated by the isolated event, that is, all of the events that define the protocol, are going to be guaranteed to be disjoint, to be isolated from any other isolated events that are executing the program. Okay? That's our goal, right? So we want to write one new combinator, we want to introduce one new abstraction that enforces isolation on all the events that take place inside a particular protocol. What does this isolation property mean? This isolation property asserts that I can never perform a communication action to a thread, in this case, say the server, if the server has already witnessed an action, a communication action from another thread, right? From another isolated event, that would break our notion of serializability. That is, that would break the notion that I see some information from A, I then see some information from B, and I see some information from A again. That's a bad thing, right? So we want to make sure that we prevent that. And we'll do that through this particular abstraction. So what I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time telling you how we actually implement that. So here's an abstract notion. Suppose I have two threads, T1 and T2, and I have two isolated computations, and I'll mark these isolated computations in red. So think of these isolated computations as enforcing serializability properties. That is to say, all of their actions must appear in the execution of this program. All of their actions must appear to occur before or after, but not interleaved with, all the other isolated computations that exist in the execution. So in this particular case, I have isolate A that communicates, that has some channels, X and Z, and isolate B that has some channels, Y and W, and these guys can now talk with other threads. Okay? Think of these threads as, say, the server threads that we had. So if A talks to T1, right, and B talks to T2, and we have this sort of cross-pairing, right, this doesn't look good, right? Because if you think about serialization, if you think about how we might serialize these two computations, there is no serial ordering of A and B that would allow the execution to complete if we had this cross pairing. So this is a violation of serializability, and we need to make sure that our isolate actions don't allow this, that our isolate combinators don't allow this to take place. Okay. Right. So what we need to do is to figure out a means of tracking how these different communications taking place within an isolate actually flow together, how they fit together. It's a little bit harder than this, right? Or it's a little bit more trickier than this. Suppose that I have four threads now, right? And each thread has a view of the world. Thread T1 says, I talk to B before I talk to A. T2 says, I talk to C before I talk to D, and so forth and so on. And they're all individually self-consistent. Everyone looks reasonable. There isn't any sort of obvious cross-pairing that seems to be problematic. And now let's pretend that T1 talks to T3 and, I'm sorry, that should be T4 over there. T1 talks to T3 and T4. And if it does, and if you just sort of think about it, you stare at this for a little bit, you can find a serialization, an ordering that makes sense with respect to this communication. It says that, well, D has to be before B, B has to be before A, and A has to be before C. That works. That seems quite reasonable. Now let's pretend that T2 also talks to T3 and T4, right? This also seems reasonable, because if you look at how things work, it seems that A has to talk before C, C has to talk before D, D talks before B. Again, everything is reasonable. But if you look at the two pictures on the, if you look at the two orderings, you find a problem, right? There's a global inconsistency here. We have two serialization orderings that individually, or in components, taken piecemeal, seems to make perfect sense. But when viewed in the aggregate, leads to something that doesn't make much sense, right? So we have a serialization violation. So what this implies is that there is certainly global knowledge that I have to keep around, but we also, unfortunately, require global knowledge as well that ensures that our isolate computations are all sort of pairwise consistent with one another. So what we're going to do is implement an extension to CML or a CML implementation, and what we're going to do is actually track communications in some form, right? So the communications that we're going to track are going to take are going to have two manifestations. There's going to be sort of local information that we maintain, and this local information that we're going to maintain is going to be information about the isolates that a particular thread has spoken with. Whenever a thread talks to another thread, there's a little consensus protocol that we'll implement that will sort of have these guys talk to one another and make sure that their consistency, that their bindings are reasonable. So if I talk to A and this other thread talk to B, then we have to sort of come up with a way that decides, well, should A really be before B or B before A, something like that. Furthermore, when we find ourselves in a situation where we do need to make a decision, right, where I spoke to A and then I now see a communication from B and I'm now stuck, I can't, from this point on, accept any further communications from A, we'll propagate this out to a global structure, right? There is a global commit point that allows us to sort of lift local information that we've gleaned to a sort of global globally consistent view.
Okay.
So now the question is, the trick that we'd like to do, or the way we'd like to sort of avoid building up a pairwise power set ordering of all different isolate computations is by essentially coming up with a scheme that allows us to track serializability with respect to an isolate and everybody else in the world. Right, we'd like to avoid doing a pairwise enumeration of A and B and B and C and C and D and so forth. What we'd like to really do is instead to say, I'm isolate A, and I'm going to execute before the rest of all the other isolates in the world. Or conversely, I'm isolate A, and all those other isolates that exist in the world, I'm going to follow them in some serial ordering, without actually having to enumerate what that particular ordering happens to be. And if we could do that, then we've sort of reduced the problem of constructing a complete graph of all possible communications to one in which we only have the complexity is linear in the number of isolates that we actually build, right? Which becomes much more tractable. And I'll give you some sort of experimental data that sort of justifies this. So here's an example. So I have an isolate A, and that cloud represents a bunch of other isolates. I don't know who they are. There may be one, there may be many, right? And in this particular model, A communicates with X, and when it does so, threat T maintains some little local information about itself. And it says, I've actually spoken with A, so I'll mark it, for the lack of a better term, better name, I'll mark it as L, because it was the left guy, okay? I now communicate again, right? I now maintain another little bit of information. This is, I've still talked to L. At the point where I receive some communication from some other isolate, which was labeled R, T is going to now lift its notion of what communication is to say, I'm now LR. That is, I spoke with isolate I sub A, and now I spoke with somebody else. And this is going to prevent, subsequently, any further communication with I sub A. Okay? So this is the way that we're going to model serializability and how we sort of achieve isolation. Right? Observe that we're isolated, R and L are isolated from one another when it counts. That is, we won't allow T to witness subsequent communications from L once it sees something from R. So here's the same example, right? If I actually saw a communication on Y from R, a subsequent communication from L is going to be violated and flagged. So this is a good thing. So we can now sort of generalize this, right, and figure out how these clouds work, right? So when I build up a thread, say L initially, I have no cloud. I'm the only one. Once I introduce a new isolate, in this case I sub B, I'll make I sub A, the guy that was previously L, to be the cloud in the world, right? Because B is now the head isolate. It's the newest isolate that I've encountered. And I sub A becomes the cloud, and we can now perform the exact operations. So when we introduce B, we'll notify I sub A that it was the left guy, but now it's the right guy because there's a new isolate in play. And we can propagate this information on every communication. And as we do so, what we'll end up finding when we finally come down here and we have these threads communicating with each other, we'll find that we automatically lift ourselves up to some kind of serial order, right? It'll either be RL or LR. And the notion of the serial ordering, which we have some freedom on, is only to prevent these threads from talking to the other bit. So if they're L, they can't talk to R. If they're LR, they can't talk to L again. Right? So I won't go through the semantics, but it's reasonably constructed. So this is all well and good, hopefully, right? You hopefully buy the argument that it works in some intuitive sense, but what is less clear is how we actually go about injecting this notion of prescience, of knowing when we should sort of move stuff from the transactional world, non-transactional world, to the transactional world, and how we actually define what the sort of choice is on this sort of commit. When do we become an LR? When do we become an RL for the purposes of isolation? So what we've done is implemented what we need to do, effectively, what a transactional event system actually has to do. It has to perform a systematic search of the possible communications such that the constraints that are imposed by transactional execution, namely atomicity and this new isolation property, are adhered to. So the question is, there are a couple of questions. When do we determine that we need to force a serialization order? So when I get a communication, when do I know that it's okay or not okay to lift this thing up to be something that prevents me from ever talking to another isolate again? How do I minimize the updates that I perform on this global map, which is required to sort of guarantee global consistency, and how do I actually determine when I sort of switch over from non-execution, from transactional to non-transactional execution. So what we've done is we've implemented this in a compiler that we've got called Milton, which, among other things, has support for something called stabilizers, which is a lightweight concurrent checkpointing algorithm, checkpointing implementation. And basically, what stabilizers do is they maintain a graph of all of the communication actions that I've performed within their scope, within their dynamic context. And this communication graph sort of gives me information about the set of potential partners, about the partners that I've communicated against, such that if I make a wrong decision, if the implementation chooses to make a wrong decision, that is, it finds itself with a never event, or it finds itself performing an isolated computation that doesn't appear to be serializable, we can sort of roll back. We can roll back our execution. But more importantly, we can keep around the graph that we already constructed, because that graph has very valuable information. In particular, it represents a counterexample that we want to make sure we don't expose, that we don't visit again. So we can essentially use this graph to prune out other choices that we know would lead to a failure, right? And so we can explore other parts of the search space. Now, it's certainly true that one can construct pathological examples where we end up essentially doing a full state space exploration. But in general, we found that this actually works extremely well. And I'll give you a small example in a minute. So the cost of doing stabilizers in the absence of transactional events is around 15% over a wide range of applications that we've studied. And the memory usage, because of the way Milton manages continuations, the way it maintains program state, is relatively small, on the order of 8% versus running these applications without any stabilizer support whatsoever. So what we do is we use stabilizers to sort of manage the search space. We're going to then figure out, we now have a scheme where on every communication action, whenever we do a communication, we're going to propagate local information from one thread to another thread. That includes this little bitmap of the possible isolates that one thread, the possible worldview of isolates that one thread has with respect to the other thread. And we join these things together. If the join works, that is, it's consistent, then we're done. If the join fails, then we abort. Okay? But we only have to do this on a communication. The second observation to note is that once we've sort of fixed a serialization order, and we only do that when we know that we have no other choice, we don't have to consult the global map again. So if I know that from a particular thread's perspective that its serialization is LR with respect to some isolate, that is, it spoke to this isolate, and now it's spoken with somebody else, so we can't speak to this guy again, we never have to consult the global map whenever we receive any further communication, because we know that that particular commit choice that we made can't be revoked. So there's some optimizations that we can employ that reduces the sort of overheads that we have. So here's a particular case study that we looked at. So we took STM Bench 7, which was a Java program originally written in Java, and we rewrote this in CML. And STM Bench 7 is sort of an abstraction of a large graph traversal. Right? It's a CAD-CAM application that traverses a whole bunch of, that traverses a very complex graph. And what we're interested in doing is trying to figure out whether we can transactionalize this. That is, we want to build a collection of clients that traverse this graph repeatedly, and we want to make sure that the executions that these clients are going to perform, for our purposes, just think of these, the nodes in the graph as little threads that accept requests for reading and writing their state, and that have edges that we can traverse to go down the graph. And all we're trying to do is, the particular example that we have, is to build 16 threads, right, that sort of traverse this graph repeatedly. And whenever we come up with a serialization violation, I'll depict what that means on the next slide, we abort. We write this program using transactional events for atomicity because we want to make sure that a traversal happens in its entirety, that we don't perform sort of updates in the middle and then find out that we made a mistake. And we use isolation to make sure that all of these 16 clients that we have operate independently, operate as though they were independent of one another. We measure this on a 16-way operon, that's why we have 16 threads. And so the question is, how much overhead do we incur in doing this? Again, a lot depends on the particular read-write ratios that we have and the particular characteristics of the problem. And I'll sort of give you a ballpark figure that we've had that averages over a number of different executions. So here's a sort of example. Here's a piece of the graph, and I have a thread that's sort of traversing down the graph, and it's doing some kind of coloring, if you will. It's sort of marking that it's visited these particular nodes. I could have another thread that comes along, right? Now the question is, this other thread may want to visit a node that is currently being visited by the thread in pink. And the question is, when should that be allowed? Well, there are clearly some cases where this is perfectly fine. For example, if I go down and I come down this particular path, right, it's as though I serialized, the blue guy was serialized after the pink guy with respect to that node in the middle. Right? On the other hand, if I visit another node, this blue node on the bottom, that ultimately gets visited again by the pink guy, we see that we have a serializability violation. There's no serial ordering that allows us to sort of color these paths consistently. And that's where we abort, right? That's a violation, that's a failure of isolation. This would manifest itself in our isolated, in our parlance, this would manifest itself as an LR guy trying to match up with an RL guy, right? I saw an L, which is the blue, I then saw the R, which was the pink, and now I'm trying to see an L again. That would be a mistake, okay? And then we would have to abort. Now the question is, where do we abort? Stabilizers will allow us to abort anywhere up this tree, right? So we can do, we can abort fully, or we can abort one level and then try again, and so forth and so on. And think of each of these edges that are coming out as choice points, right? These are points where I could have taken either way, and that's where, and I'll try to find the closest such choice point to examine next. Yes. 400,000, right? So in the configuration that we ran our experiments on, we had 400,000 CML threads.
So do you think it's a good concurrency model for this particular?
It's a very.
Just one whole thread is quite small.
It's very fine grained, absolutely, and so. It's conceivable that as we scale up, right, these graphs are relatively small, right, when you think about it. And as you scale up, you would presumably want to have larger threads aggregating over a series of nodes. The way that STM bench works, it partitions, there's actually several graphs that are combined together. So there's a parts graph, and then there's a tree sitting somewhere, and so forth and so on. And one can imagine that if you had very, very large scale, large size programs, you'd want to sort of provide better aggregation. But for our purposes, we were just trying to sort of stress test the system, because every thread communication entails an action that involves communication of these isolate pieces. So it was sort of, it seemed a good choice for us to try to figure out how much overheads we're incurring by having to communicate these extra bits, these extra serialization bits. As a general programming model, I'm not so sure. No. Yeah. They're very small, right? They're very, very tiny. So, so in Milton, it costs us about 13% to do the serialization check over what we would get if we just ran this code without any kind of support for transactional events or isolation. And that seems very reasonable to us for first cut. Right, and we believe we can do better. So our hope is that even though it is quite true that the search space exploration that one could conceivably perform with the transactional event model and the sort of overheads that one has can perceivably incur by trying to maintain full notions of isolation could be pathologically very bad, right? We at least have one example that we think is somewhat reasonable that indicates that it's reasonable. So I won't make any further claims about the feasibility of this other than that. And you know, we're continuing to experiment to see how far we can get. So with that in mind, let me summarize, let me close, and I'll take any questions.
Thanks. Thank you very much. So we have a little time for questions. As usual, can people wait for me to dynamically deliver the microphone so your words can be duly recorded?
But I'll stick to just one. So you've spoken repeatedly about serializability Now, in a kind of imperative language with atomic regions, I know what that means. I mean, those atomic regions occur in one order or the other, right? And I can reason about them using sequential logic, all that kind of thing. I don't think I understand, in the context of CML, what serializability might mean. Because, of course, any one event thing is of course, running along with other ones because it's synchronous. So what does it mean?
So give
what reasoning can I do about my program if I have your system that I cannot do without?
If you take my system and you write a CML program that has two isolate events, you can ensure that all of the events in one isolate, all of the effects induced by the events in one isolate, occur before the events in the other. That is, there's no interleaving of event actions across different isolates. No, that's the point. That's the exact point. If I have two isolate events, that's what isolate means. That you have these two events, they can talk to a whole bunch of other guys. They can talk to all sorts of people, and these guys might talk to all sorts of other people. But what we guarantee is that the effects of one will never spill over to the other. So you can order them, so you can reason about it as though one isolate, I ran this particular thread with this isolate to completion before I ran the other guy. That's the notion of serializability. That's exactly what we were saying with client A and client B, right? We do client A, it's doing a whole bunch of stuff. It's talking to, doing a whole bunch of communication. We want to ensure that all of those communications happen or none happen before we do anything with client B. And these client A and client B are... Huh?
The server's doing an ISOL too, isn't it?
Yes, but the server will not witness requests, will not honor requests from this other client as long as it's running this isolate, as long as it's in the middle of dealing with this isolate. Once this isolate says, I'm done, I'm finished with my request, the server can certainly accept requests from other guys, right? That was the point. Sure.
So does it make sense for there to be a notion of nesting between isolates? For example, the client wants to do some isolated stuff. It sends a message to a server, and then the server itself wants to do some isolated stuff as part of that.
Yeah, so we have nesting.
Service of the client.
Absolutely. So there is a nesting model that we have, right? So you have to sort of keep a stack, if you will, of the isolate computations that you've performed. And it's not reasonable to think about flattening all of this. You can lead to behavior that's different.
And although the models are different, and my use of terminology here probably isn't really right, I'd almost see an isolate as being like an atomic clock in C# or Java, where...
So I think the confusion is that I think the term transactional event that was introduced was a misnomer, because you expect transactions to provide atomicity and isolation, and a transactional event only provides one. It allows an atomic unit to occur, but it doesn't restrict the visibility between different. It doesn't restrict visibility in any way. Anybody can participate in a transactional. So I think the confusion, in some sense, arises from the fact that we have a notion of a transactional event that really isn't transactional in the classical sense of the term as used in shared memory in shared memory implementations.
And the other confusion I had initially when you were introducing these ideas was whether isolated just meant this kind of serializability style property or some kind of information flow property as well. You know, I might want to write a program where one I have a red client and a blue client. I want to be sure that they're talking through a server, not just that they're going to be ordered with respect to each other, but that the server isn't going to leak red stuff into the blue world and vice versa.
Yeah, so right, absolutely. What we've done so far is only think about what isolate computations mean with respect to this notion of atomicity, right? That is, they're all encapsulated as part of this larger entity. And our semantics, it doesn't really model isolation independent of atomicity. But I think that's a very, but my initial slide sort of alluded to that, which is why, and so I'm certainly very interested in seeing how we can pursue that direction. But so far, we've only focused on this sort of much more limited notion. But information flow is certainly a possibility.
Thank you.
Questions? Oh, then, thanks, Rush, again.
Thanks.